A good rule of thumb for LinkedIn content if you're just getting started. A good question to ask yourself is, will sharing this content help someone in my network? And if your answer is yes, it's probably a good thing to share.
みなさん、こんにちは。ビジネスサクセスジャパンのポッドキャストへようこそ。Hello everyone and welcome to the Business Success Japan podcast. This is your host, Lydie Buchelman. This podcast is made for those who want to develop or strengthen the communication skills, cultural savvy, insights into current trends and conditions, and mindsets that are essential in a Japanese business environment. The helpful, practical suggestions and engaging insights offered here provide listeners with the in-depth cultural context needed to achieve their own version of success while collaborating with Japanese counterparts. Today, I'm very excited to share a follow-up interview that I had with Anthony Griffin. He was originally one of my very first guests all the way back in 2020, so this conversation was definitely overdue. Anthony Griffin is a marketer and communications coach who helps Japanese companies market to international audiences. Before founding Saga Consulting, he served as the marketing and communications manager for the American Chamber of Commerce in Japan. As a communications coach, he has helped Fortune 500 executives earn global-level promotions. Before moving to Japan in 2009, he managed the workflow of over 250 marketing projects a year for the city of Riverside, California. As a marketing consultant and copywriter, he leveraged his MBA degree to help local businesses achieve exponential returns on their marketing investments. A lifelong learner and teacher, Anthony speaks Japanese proficiently and often gives marketing and communication lectures at universities and corporations. Be sure to check out his links in the description of this episode to learn more. But before we get into the interview for today, I have something very exciting to share with my Tokyo listeners. On May 11th at 2 p.m., Tokyo Comedy Bar will be hosting a live fireside-style chat with previous guests of the Business Success Japan podcast. While we're still working out some of the details, we're hoping to donate any profits on the tickets to Tell Japan, which is an organization dedicated to providing effective support and counseling services to Japan's international community and its increasing mental health needs. It should also be a great opportunity to connect with other like-minded Business Success Japan listeners, and as you'll hear in this episode, your connections are likely to be the key to your success in Japan. So be sure to follow me on LinkedIn if you haven't already to stay up to date on additional details. I also wanted to take a moment to apologize for the audio quality in this interview. I've been trying out different recording platforms, and the one I used for this chat was definitely not a winner. However, I did not want to re-record it and let the great insights that came up during our conversation go to waste, so I hope that you will still enjoy it. And without any further delay, let's get into today's interview.
Thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. I know it's been a while since you've been on the podcast, and as it is one of the earlier interviews, I will link it in the description, but I will not necessarily encourage people to go listen to it because I was still definitely learning how to be an interviewer in the podcast format. But yeah, I'm excited to kind of revisit some things and dig more into how things are in Japan right now. But just to get started, would you mind briefly introducing yourself to my audience?
Sure. And thank you for having me back. It's great to be here again. My name is Anthony Griffin, and I am a marketer and communications consultant based here in Tokyo, Japan. I've been doing this for several years, coming up on 6 years now independently, but I've been living in Japan, training people, doing marketing for almost 15 years now.
Great. So would you mind telling us a little bit about your history with Japan?
Sure. That's a long story. I'll try to give a brief version with maybe some new information. But as many of your listeners may know, I'm originally from California. I grew up in the 80s, and that was when Japan was going through what is called the bubble jidai, or the bubble era, where, you know, everyone felt Japan was going to take over the world. What that meant as a youth in California is all of the coolest things, all of the highest quality things in my life were coming from Japan, be it the best technology, you know, the best automobiles, the most entertaining, the most fascinating pop culture, games, animation, and all of that. So I grew up with an incredibly positive impression of Japan. Fast forward to college as a business major, I had to study 1 year of a foreign language. And I said, this is my chance to try Japanese, this language very different from my own. I had already studied Spanish. I wanted to do something new. I thought I would fail 100% and then I could put all of it behind me, but I did very well. Unfortunately, I didn't run off to Japan immediately. I had some other dreams to chase. I wanted to work in the video game industry. I did that. I wanted to earn my MBA. I did that. And finally, I settled into a marketing career, which allowed me to visit Japan and travel to Japan. And after going there two times, I thought, this seems like a place I might want to live. So I looked into living in Japan. I thought I would be here just a year, and 1 year has turned into almost 15. So that brings me here today.
Great. And just coming here for visits, what was it about Japan that made you suspect it would be a good place for you to settle down?
That is an excellent question. No one has asked me that. And I don't know if I can point to one concrete thing. I guess what I realize is until that time, whenever I took a vacation, whenever I traveled, even if it's the nicest place in the world, for example, Hawaii, after you're there for a while, you feel like, okay, it's time to get home. I want to get back into my routine. It's been fun. I'm ready to go home. But when I came to Japan, I never had that feeling. It's like, I want to stay here. In fact, I wrote in one article for Kokoro Media, one of the platforms I write a lot for, that I almost sabotaged my return trip to America by trying to buy train tickets in very elementary Japanese. So I really wasn't concerned about coming home. As to why I felt that way, given I could barely speak the language, I looked different, everything was different. Maybe it was just the safety, or I'm a very, I don't want to say organized, but majime, as we would say in Japanese, a straightforward person. I like organization, I like structure, I like routine, and Japan offered me a lot of that. So on this subconscious level, it just felt like a good fit, even though, you know, I was a total stranger here.
Yeah, it is nice to be in a place where things are a little bit more predictable in terms of how things are going to be organized, a little bit more uniform in terms of what you're going to encounter on a day-to-day basis. So I can definitely see how that would be appealing if you are a little bit more of a meticulous person.
I think you just said it better than I could. So thank you. Yeah, a lot of that societal predictability, and that's everything from, you know, your train arriving on time almost every day to the prediction of what festival is going to come up at what time of year and what people are going to do and how they're going to celebrate those festivals. So thank you for organizing all that so clearly.
So would you mind just digging in a little bit more about what specifically you do now in terms of work on a day-to-day basis?
Sure, absolutely. So what I do is I primarily focus on Japan-based companies who need to market and or communicate abroad. So what does that look like? It typically involves content marketing. So that's writing content about companies, products, or services in usually blog or article format to grow their brand abroad. That also results in social media management, mostly LinkedIn. So I'll manage a company's LinkedIn presence. I'll consult them. I'll create content. I'll provide analytics for them. And then finally, I also do a lot of coaching, communications coaching, mainly for English-speaking Japanese executives who are concerned about doing business abroad. This could be anything from how to give a presentation, how to network networking events, for example, business email writing, those kinds of things as well. So the business is kind of evenly divided between all that, and that's basically a culmination of all the things I've been doing here in Japan and the U.S.
Yeah, that's great. And coming back to coaching that you were talking about, what specific things are people concerned most about in terms of being effective? And I just feel like a lot of people have a lot of anxiety, obviously, about moving abroad. They don't know what to expect. But does anything stand out to you in terms of what people are most concerned about learning before they go abroad?
I guess the best way to answer that is to look at, out of all the seminars I have, including, you know, marketing, HR, mini MBA courses, there's three that are the consistent best sellers, and that would be global presentations, business email writing, and then LinkedIn and personal branding. So that's a combination of presenting yourself on LinkedIn, but also how to present yourself at a networking event or in public. So in my world, those are the three most popular things. I think in our previous podcast, we also talked about some people find their way through me through a language concern. So they're concerned about even speaking English, and then they approach me, as I used to be an English teacher, and I have an hour-long conversation with them in fluent English, and then I have to break the news to them and say, well, you don't really have a language problem, but I notice you have concerns about managing this meeting that you have to do, or going to this networking event, or something like that, or negotiations. That's another big one as well. So that's also a common path to how people find their way to my services.
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. And if you don't mind just digging in a little bit more about how those things function differently in Japan versus, both of us are from America, so probably more of an American lens. Because from the outside, it sounds like business emails would just be business emails. Like, what's the big deal about the cultural nuances? You're just trying to make transactions. So how can that be so confusing for people?
Well, I don't want to be cliche, but there's that meme or that joke that's going around the LinkedIn or the internet about how, you know, the Japanese email, you have all these set phrases at the beginning, maybe the typical greeting about the weather and some nice prose about that. Then you maybe have the main content in the middle, and then another set phrase, you know, yoroshiku o negai itashimasu, and all of that at the end. However, you know, Western emails, depending on the corporate culture, especially maybe in the startup scene, or if you're emailing a busy executive, an email can be super brief, just two or three lines, for example. And a lot of people I work with have trouble adjusting to that as well. Then there's just, you know, what kind of vocabulary do you use? What is the best and most efficient way to arrange appointments and meetings and things like that? But a lot of it is just kind of the cultural structure of the email, and the fact that in the States, depending on what kind of company you're writing, be it a startup or a legal firm, you're going to have to take a different approach in your email.
Mm-hmm. And it is a little bit more complicated in the US because every company has a very distinct culture too, which is true in Japan as well, but I feel like it's still a little bit more predictable what a company is going to expect from you.
Yeah, here, definitely more predictable. There's definitely set phrases that you can almost use universally, where in the States, that's not necessarily the case. On top of that, too, you know, we have a very diverse population. So you're dealing with people from different backgrounds, different levels of English understanding. So, yeah, there's a lot to process there.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And then it's also been a while since we've talked about what makes an effective presentation, because in Japan, what's expected of you when making a presentation is quite a bit different. Would you mind highlighting some of those things?
Absolutely. And again, I want to avoid sounding cliche, but it's the truth. You know, sometimes cliches appear because there's a lot of truth to them. I've said this before, but the biggest, most obvious difference it happens to be in slide design. You know, everyone says in Japan, the slides are just loaded with information. People have called it death by bullet points, graphs with tons of information that you can't possibly read. So a lot of the work I do is breaking that down and designing lighter slides that are easier to digest, and making slides the background of your presentation. You know, the speaker, well, technically the audience should be the focus, but after that, the speaker, not your slides, should be the focus of the presentation. So working on that, kind of bringing the speaker to the forefront, the slides to the background, that's one thing we do. A lot of pushback that I get is, well, Anthony, what if my audience needs all of these details and bullet points and 10,000 numbers and things like that? Then my response is, well, you can put that in a handout and distribute it after your presentation. Then you can put everything you want in there. So that's one side. Another aspect that we work on that is less common is making presentations more engaging. You know, and this is something I see in all over the world, actually, not just Japan, but a lot of people approach presentations as a chore or a burden, something they have to do or something they have to get over with, when really for a presentation, your audience is donating their time and attention to you. So you have to reward them for that. You have to make it worth their time. So a lot of my training has to do with making a compelling introduction, introducing interesting questions, or starting with a story or telling a story through your presentation, for example, opening with compelling statistics to grab the audience's attention. And then, of course, making proper conclusions with interesting quotes, for example, more storytelling. And then finally, for sales and marketing professionals, we go over having a compelling call to action at the end. Tell the audience what you would like them to do with this valuable information you've shared with them. So those are some of the things that we often work on.
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. And I wonder how much that will be changing as things get more globalized in Japan. But for now, it does seem that the stereotypical presentation is holding, unfortunately, in Japan.
Yeah, I've been attending a lot of events at the Tokyo Chamber of Commerce, which is 100% Japanese. Fantastic organization, by the way, but a lot of the presentations are still in this traditional format. So, and it works. I think it works for the audience here, especially because it's basically an all Japanese audience. My message is just working with people and saying, this is great for Japan, no problem. But if you want to engage international audiences, we need to accommodate that. We need to make some changes.
Yeah, definitely. Just to clarify, I don't mean in like a objective way. I just mean for me as somebody with a limited attention span, it's unfortunate that they haven't quite moved to a little bit more of an engaging style just for my own sake.
Got it. Well, I'm sure many people agree with you. And again, a lot of this, these things are universal too. I mean, there's plenty of people in America, Europe that are still kind of doing presentations the old fashioned way. So I don't know. Maybe this is a product and service I can take beyond Japan. So if anyone's listening to this podcast out there, let me know if that's interesting for you.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a big pain point for a lot of people. And it's something that's kind of hard to fix by yourself. You really need somebody to walk you through your blind spots in that sort of situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what makes personal branding different in Japan versus what you try to encourage people to do when they're engaging cross-culturally?
Well, from my experience, and I don't want to say that everyone is like this, but personal branding is just not a big thing here. You know, it's all about the company. It's all about the group identity. You know, when people introduce themselves, they often introduce themselves connected with their company. When you open an email from a Japanese professional, it's not just they don't just say their name. They say, I'm so-and-so with so-and-such and such company. So, there's a lot of space to grow in the personal branding scene here. But again, it's probably something that's not so necessary if you are doing, for example, what I call J2J marketing, where you're a Japanese person trying to sell or interact with other Japanese people. Again, that system is in place. But if you are trying to start a business globally, or you're trying to find customers globally, then you're going to want to develop that personal brand online and offline. And as you probably know, LinkedIn plays a big part in that.
Yeah, for sure. So if somebody is moving more in that J2J space, would you think that having a big focus on personal branding might actually backfire in some way?
That's a good question. I hope not, because I do a lot of personal branding. You know, I think it depends on where you're from. If you're Japanese doing that, it might backfire. I wouldn't know for sure. I do see, you know, Japanese professionals doing personal branding, but they're usually sole proprietors or something like that, working for themselves. As a foreigner, I hate to say it, we have a little bit of leeway with how we present ourselves. And I think it could be an actual advantage if you don't have any brand, you're not associated with a big company, but you're trying to do business here. It might benefit you to have an online presence so people can develop trust, because trust is big here. And usually that's achieved through interactions over time. But if you're a foreigner coming here, you want to get a faster start, you might have to put yourself out there. So when you meet a Japanese professional or a potential client, you can exchange business cards with them. And then when they go home and look at your website, they can see your face, they can learn about you. And maybe that could accelerate the trust process if you have a strong personal brand that way. So I think that's one of the advantages we have as sole proprietors or small businesses. It's stressful sometimes to put yourself out there. And if I had it my way, I wouldn't be so visible on the internet. But at the same time, it's one of the only ways to build trust faster here in Japan is being someone that people can see, that they can reach out to, and quickly learn about who you are. So it's a complicated issue. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And before we started recording, we both were commiserating over the fact that we don't necessarily like having our voices or our images out there, but it kind of comes with the territory.
Well said, Lydia. It comes with the territory. And you know, doing business is not always about doing what we're comfortable with or just doing what we like. Sometimes, like you said, it comes with the territory. We have to do what we have to do. And I believe that's having a personal brand here in Japan as a small business, as an unknown quantity, can definitely help you.
Yeah, for sure. So what makes LinkedIn an especially powerful tool for people hoping to build a Japan-related career?
Well, first, let's talk about the elephant in the room. LinkedIn is not popular here among the Japanese population. I think estimates say there's maybe about 3 million users. So it's not a popular network. It's been struggling for years. However, as I often coach my social media clients, sometimes it's not always about the quantity of users or followers, but it's about the quality. Who is there? And that's where the power of LinkedIn comes in. Because even though it's a small group comparatively compared to Facebook or Twitter or X, excuse me, or other brands out there, the people there could be right in your target zone. So for example, there are still a lot of international companies or Japanese companies recruiting on LinkedIn. And if they are using LinkedIn as opposed to one of the standard Japanese solutions, they're probably more open to hiring or working with international people. So if that's your target, if you're trying to get a job in Japan, you're probably going to have a better time on LinkedIn than one of the traditional methods, even if it's a smaller audience. And then secondly, as an expat or someone coming into this world, the expat or the foreign community in Japan on LinkedIn is incredibly powerful. You know, you and I believe we met on LinkedIn during the pandemic, and so many people who were just coming from other countries, getting online, getting involved in the foreign, or I should say international LinkedIn community, because there are a lot of bilingual, globally minded Japanese professionals on LinkedIn as well. It's simply the best platform for that. So if you're looking for like-minded individuals, if you're looking for advice from legal to immigration to business tips, if you're just looking for friends even, LinkedIn is a fantastic place for that. And I can give a very specific tip right off the bat. Just go to the Business in Japan group, BIJ, right there. If you just jump right into that group, you're going to have an amazing network. So yeah, LinkedIn is the underdog here, but if you look at it as a niche, and a niche player can be a powerful player, it's just a fantastic platform.
For sure. I definitely second the Business in Japan recommendation. And as of the time of recording, and hopefully they will continue, they have a weekly little lunchtime networking event that everybody can participate in. So that's a great way to just hear a little bit more about what people are around, what they're doing, what they're interested in, what you might be able to help them with, things like that. So it's definitely worth checking out if that's accessible to you. And a friend of yours who I recently connected with as well, we were also just talking about how there's something really distinct about the expat community in Japan. For whatever reason, people are just always quite invested in helping each other a lot more than I've seen in other countries, or just if you're at your in your home country, just for whatever reason, the people who are fellow expats in Japan just are a lot more willing to help and be invested in the people around them. So definitely don't be afraid to reach out and make some connections in the community.
Yeah, very, very well said. I think maybe just because the difference between kind of the foreign population and Japan is so stark compared to other countries around the world, perhaps that unconsciously drives us to kind of look out for each other and group together. So as you mentioned, it's great to get involved and see who can help you, but also, as you mentioned, see who you can help.
For sure. It's nice to be in a community where the vibe is much more a rising tide raises all ships instead of a zero-sum game. It's very refreshing.
Yes, definitely.
And it's not 100% of people, of course, but yes, this is the general.
Yeah, we should temper everything we say. Nothing we say is 100%, and we might get into it later, but there are definitely some bad actors on there as well. But compared to other social networks, it's definitely the minority, I would say.
Yes, it's kind of like safety in Japan, where it's not 100% safe. You can be more comfortable than you might be in your own country, but still be careful. Don't trust everybody implicitly.
Right. You use a general common sense.
Yeah, for sure. So apart from getting involved in the Business in Japan community, what are some other advice you have for how people can try to use LinkedIn more effectively?
Okay, well, I could talk about this forever. So I'll try to narrow it down to just a few points. First and foremost, so you and I, we just talked about getting in touch with people, but LinkedIn has a form of etiquette. So when you reach out to someone to connect, please make sure that you leave a little message explaining specifically why you would like to connect to that person. I know on the mobile version of the app, there's some UX problems that make that hard to do, but the option is there. Just poke around on one of the menu buttons. You can find it. But this is very important because, as you and I just mentioned, there are bad actors out there. There are scammers. And as LinkedIn gets more popular globally, this number is increasing. So people like you and I that are always on LinkedIn, we're trying to grow this quality network. We're very careful about who we connect with. So when you reach out, please leave a message. Give a specific reason for reaching out. That could be something like, I really appreciated this content you shared. I'd like to know more. I would like to learn more about getting a job in Japan, and I saw what you have accomplished, or anything like that. But make sure we can tell that you're a legitimate person and not someone trying to sell us the random thing out there. And then secondly, if you are a creative, if you're a writer, a coder, a photographer, a graphic designer, make use of all of LinkedIn's features to have a portfolio. You know, this goes back to personal branding. So if you're trying to sell those services or get a job based on those services, make sure that anyone on LinkedIn can quickly see and sample your work. LinkedIn has a built-in blog feature on your profile. It's much more than a resume. It's a rich platform where you can put links if you have a portfolio outside of LinkedIn, which I highly recommend, more so than LinkedIn, is have your own home base on the web. You can link out to that. But if that's too much, or you don't want to design your own website or build your own website, all of that can be on LinkedIn. So make sure that's there. As a former marketing manager, and even as a sole proprietor right now, I still hire people for certain tasks. And I'm so surprised how many people who say that they're a writer or a designer don't have a portfolio. I can't see their work. So if you can just have an online presence or a portfolio, that's going to put you ahead of at least 60 to 80% of the competition right there. So use LinkedIn's tools to showcase yourself. And then finally, just be a little careful about the content you create and share. it is quite different than Facebook. So LinkedIn is considered a professional social network. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have a little fun. As I tell my clients, you can't take the social out of social media or a social network, but you don't want to be posting strong political opinions or maybe yesterday's lunch with no context or the kinds of things you'll see on Facebook. When in doubt, you know, just kind of sign in if you're just getting started and look around at what your network is sharing, the kind of content that they're sharing, and start with content that's in line with that. So those are the three things that I'd recommend for getting started with LinkedIn.
Right. And if you're somebody who struggles getting started, especially because the platform itself does feel a little bit more intimidating when you first log in, a great option is just when you find content that you find interesting, they have a great option available for you to just repost the content. You can add your own comment up top. That's a really great way to just kind of build the muscle of starting to post and create content on LinkedIn. That's a little bit lower stakes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a good point, Lydia. You know, a lot of people are doing kind of these long form posts natively in LinkedIn, which seems to be effective, but that's not the only thing you can or have to do. Just like you said, if you see something you like that will benefit your network, amplify that, share that on your network. You can just straight repost it if you're really in a hurry. Or like you said, you can add your commentary on there, but it's a good rule of thumb for LinkedIn content, if you're just getting started, a good question to ask yourself is, will sharing this content help someone in my network? And if your answer is yes, it's probably a good thing to share.
That's definitely a good approach to take just in life, but especially in a business context, and then especially in a Japanese business context. That's a really good approach to take.
Well said. Well said.
So then, just based on what you've been seeing lately, maybe current trends in Japan or current trends abroad, what are some ways that people can be more effective when marketing in Japan specifically, if somebody's interested in that?
Great question. Although, you know, I primarily focus on helping Japanese companies market abroad, I have to market myself here in Japan. So for me, as a small sole proprietor, the number one advice I could give if you're in my situation is to remember the definition of marketing. Remember, marketing is not only digital marketing. You know, ever since digital marketing took off as an affordable, trackable medium, it kind of took over the definition of marketing. But remember, there's all kinds of advertising and marketing. There's, you know, meeting people face to face. There's email marketing, there's direct selling, you know, approaching people directly. If you look at what Japanese companies are doing, a highly yet unconventional to us method is handing out tissues with advertisements in it on the street. So my advice is to remember that there's so many options there. As a sole proprietor, one strategy I recommend is make sure you have this online digital presence, make sure that's there, but do a lot of personal selling or networking, building up your network, going to networking events and introducing yourself to people in person. Again, accelerating that trust process by showing that you're a real person, that you're here committed to Japan, for example. And then you have your digital presence to back up what you say. So if you go to a networking event and say, I'm a digital marketer, I help Japanese people with their LinkedIn profile, then they go home, see your digital presence and say, oh yeah, wow, he's really doing that. I might contact him. He made a nice impression on me. So that's one approach for people like me. For larger organizations, and this probably goes both ways, but it's all about proper localization. It's all about avoiding that sin of saying, okay, this marketing approach worked in my country. It's going to work in Japan, no problem. So you don't want to rely on machine translation. You don't even want to rely on a literal translation. You want to hire someone who can properly localize the marketing around your product. And then again, you want to look beyond copywriting and digital marketing. You want to make sure that your package size is appropriate. If you have a physical good, the, you know, supermarkets and retail stores, we're working with a lot less shelf space than in a place like America. So if your package is the wrong size or it doesn't fit anywhere, it's not designed correctly, you'll already lose. So I think a good industry to look at for this might be the food industry. So a while back, I did an interview with Gourmet Pro, a food industry market entry specialist. And that is because the standards in that industry are so strict and the bar is so high that if you can learn something or enter the market in that industry, you can probably do any product or service. So those are some thoughts on this kind of Japan marketing market entry topic.
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense and highlights how it's usually things that we don't even think about that could be potential issues just coming up. So it pays to have somebody on your side who can point out those things that you would never dream of being a problem, like the shelf size just being different.
Yeah. Just if you haven't lived here and existed here and you want to enter this market, there are just so many things that you can't imagine. It could be even the name of your product. You might have to change the name of your product if it sounds like something that's negative over here. There are just so many things to think of. So it all comes back to remembering kind of the broader meaning of marketing and all that's involved with it.
Yeah, for sure. And it might even just be too soon to tell, but with the rise of increasingly powerful translation software, tools like ChatGPT, I'm personally a little bit concerned that companies will, because the output looks so much better than it used to, companies will be a little bit more eager to just try to push all of their marketing efforts onto this automatic software that may not be capable of doing that sort of hard localization work. But have you seen any moves towards that yet, or is it a little bit too soon?
I mean, there's always stories about that, people attempting that, and it's certainly helping people already. I haven't heard of success stories relying entirely on that yet. And it is getting better. It is impressive. It's a helpful tool. The way I like to think about it is, imagine if you and I are shopping online for identical products in English and in the US, and everything is almost identical, but one of the sites we're looking at maybe has two or three typos on their page. Which product are we going to choose? The one with the near perfect copy is more trustworthy. So as long as, you know, AI and these things are even having minor mistakes or minor errors in their translation, you still can't rely on them 100%. You're still going to need a human component if you are being competitive and trying to have the best web presence out there. So I don't want to dismiss the technology entirely. It's definitely a help. Jobs are threatened. Jobs are changing. And people are certainly going to try to rely on that 100%. But I don't think we're there yet. And I think if you want to be the best of the best, you're still going to need human involvement.
Yeah, for sure. Having that final 2-3% closer to perfection could probably go a long way in
exactly.
That context.
Yeah, if you're competing at the top, you know, every percent's going to matter.
Yeah, for sure. So then, speaking of Japanese companies, when we were brainstorming this episode, you kind of mentioned that you've noticed that Japanese companies are becoming increasingly interested in expanding to the US market, which has not always been the case in the most recent few decades. Do you have any idea why that might be? Like, why now?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot, because in my personal experience, when I first came to Japan, I was very bright-eyed and excited. And I'm like, wow, you know, America and Japan have this great relationship. There's going to be so many companies I can help, you know, succeed abroad. But at that time, around 2009, it was all about China. So Japanese companies had pretty much given up on market entry in the US, at least smaller players. And honestly, it was a legitimate move back then. You know, America is, for most products and services, is considered a mature market, and it's extremely competitive. So where China was growing and was booming, and other Asian countries were booming, and they're much geographically closer, so it made sense. So I kind of got used to that and found my niche set of clients. Then we had the pandemic, and then coming out of that, as I started networking in person and talking to people, I noticed a lot more interest in entering the U.S., and I was quite surprised. And so I looked into it, and one major reason seems to be, and I'm not an expert on this field, but it seems to be the geopolitical shift. Japan is very close to the U.S. for many reasons, through history and military and trade and all of that. And there's, you know, if you look at the economic work of someone such as Richard Katz, for example, he's writing a lot about this right now. Countries all over the world they're not pivoting away from China 100%, but they're diversifying their business. And I feel that Japan is going along with that. Additionally, here in Japan, the government and the private sector are much more in sync, especially the larger companies. So if large companies see the Japanese government kind of pivoting more closely to America for whatever reason, be it military or economic, they're going to subtly follow suit. So there's probably more reasons to it, but so far what the biggest one I've observed seems to be geopolitical. Despite that, however, at this stage, most of it is curiosity and experimentation. I've still found with large and small companies alike, they're not quite prepared for the investment that it does take. Because one thing that hasn't changed is, again, for a lot of products and services, America is a mature market, is very competitive. And just like American companies coming into Japan, Japanese companies going to America need to invest significantly in localization as well. So there's definitely a shift. We'll see if it accelerates or not, because it does require a lot of investment.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense that companies would be more interested in diversifying their portfolios right now, just with how unstable things have been in just the past few years. I can see how that might make them a little bit more curious about a more mature, difficult to break into market, but one that is generally a little bit more stable.
Yeah, exactly.
So then what are some concerns that Japanese companies might have surrounding things like intellectual property when moving abroad?
Sure. Beyond the basics, and unfortunately, I'm not too well versed in the legal aspects of intellectual property. But, you know, we've seen over the years, especially in pop culture, entertainment, video games, that, you know, sometimes if you have a product name, it's already taken in the U.S. and or it has a strange meaning in the U.S. So you have to do your homework and see what exists there. You have to search your name and see how it's used in America. But beyond that, what I have observed and what I'm more versed in is the power that Japanese intellectual property has in the States, especially. And I think the larger companies in the pop culture industry, such as manga and games, are starting to realize this. To give you an example, in the comic book industry, not including the movies or anything like that, the American comic book industry is actually dominated by Japan right now. Japanese brands, such as like the Shonen Jump series, are dominating homegrown giants such as Marvel and DC right now. That's incredible. So in my 44 years of existence, I've never seen such a hunger for Japanese IP abroad. So big companies are starting to leverage this. But when I talk to kind of smaller business owners and startups, they're not aware of how powerful and how in demand Japanese products and services are abroad. But Japan, brand Japan, has an amazing perception, amazing demand. So there is a lot of opportunity to grow your IP abroad. And we're starting to see this also in Hollywood. Finally, you know, one of the biggest movies this year was the Super Mario Brothers movie. You know, they finally could transfer that IP from a game into a movie. And one of the ways they did that was being authentic. You know, this is a far cry from that first Mario movie that came out when we were much younger, where they changed everything. It didn't look like the game at all. Where if you watch this new Super Mario movie, it's basically like watching the game. And sure, maybe the critics didn't like that, but the fans came out in droves. So, and you can see that with other brands. You can see a resurgence in the Japanese game industry, where Japanese brands are leading the charge in terms of quality, review scores, and actually turning a profit on the games that they make. So yeah, regarding IP, if there's one thing I could say to Japanese companies who have not realized this, is there's a huge demand for your brand abroad.
Yeah, definitely. And it will be great to see in the future what opportunities that opens up for people who have experience working and living in Japan, because they're going to need some amount of localization moving those products into the United States or into Europe, into India, wherever you're from. So that could be a great way for people to be able to share what it is that they love about Japan with people back in their home country. So that'll be great to see in the coming years.
Yeah, I'm certainly hoping that, as you know, that's a big part of my business is that process. So I'm certainly hoping for that. And coincidentally, I just wrote a blog post about this topic on my blog at Saga Consulting. And I really hope that it does create opportunities, not only for Japan, but for the foreign community living here.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, you generally spend most of your time working with people in Japan who are going abroad for business. But if you were chatting with somebody from abroad who was hoping to come to Japan for business, and they didn't have a lot of time to learn anything about the country or its culture ahead of time, what would you emphasize that they take the time to learn about before coming here?
Wow. There's just so much. So I would like to just condense this not to a thing, but an attitude. And if there's one thing I could say, it would be, don't think of Japan as just another country or just another version of where you're from. Think of it as an entirely different planet. And I say this in the most neutral way. I don't say that as a negative at all, but I think that's a healthy mindset, because this isn't intentional, but through history, Japan has developed in a unique way that sets it apart from many other countries in the world. First of all, geographically, it's an island nation. Secondly, it's a nation that has never been colonized, and you feel that in the culture. It is different. You know, I've traveled to several other countries in Asia. In fact, I was just in Malaysia recently, and even though that's considered an Asian country, I find it has much more in common with the U.S. than Japan. So Japan is just its own thing. And what that means, and again, there's no negativity here, it's just a reality. You need to come here with a very open mind, and you never want to bring that mentality of, okay, I do it this way in my country, this is just another country, it's going to work here. No, you want to come in with an open mind. You want to learn how things work on planet Japan and try to follow the norms here. And then after that, you can start looking for the places where we do have overlap and intersections. And then you can start kind of making suggestions on how to help people go abroad, or you can look and find your niche or whatever you need to do. But, you know, come in with that mindset. It's a different world here. That's not a bad thing. Having that mentality is something that will help you.
Yeah, definitely. It's so hard to come into Japan with no assumptions, but the fewer of those that you can bring along with you, the better, I think.
Yeah, well said. Maybe I put the bar too high. You know, we're all human. We can't help but compare things. You're right. But yeah, you said it even better. The fewer assumptions you can have, the better you're going to be.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard because people tend to fall into the camp of thinking of Japan as this wonderful, mysterious thing, which it is in a lot of ways, but people are still people. So it's hard to hold that dichotomy in both hands, where you don't want to make assumptions about Japan, but you are still dealing with people in the same world as you. So yeah, it's just a little bit of a difficult thing to deal with.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, every country, you're going to have good and bad, and you're going to have positive experiences and negative experiences. And, you know, I hope that the majority of your experiences here are positive, but you have to come in with that realistic, balanced attitude. Wherever you go in the world, people are people. That is the one thing we do have in common, and you need to be ready for that.
For sure. And I appreciate you being so generous with your time, not just once, but two times, sharing it and your wisdom on the podcast. Is there anything that you wish I'd asked you about, or that you wish that you'd had a little bit more time to discuss in today's conversation?
You know, this is our second round at this, and I always enjoy your questions. You're always very thorough. So I think we've covered everything. I would just encourage people to reach out to either of us if, you know, they have questions about this podcast, or, you know, they're interested in Japan. But other than that, yeah, I'm grateful for the chance to come back. And, you know, maybe in a year or two, we can do round three.
Yeah, for sure. And be sure to check out all of the links in the description of this episode to find more great content that he's posting on his own blog and on Kokoro Media. So be sure to check that out. I will do my best to be pretty thorough in there as well in terms of the content. So thank you again for coming back on.
Thank you so much. It's been a true pleasure.
Thank you for listening, and I hope that you enjoyed today's conversation. Be sure to check out the links in the description of this episode to learn more from Anthony. And if you happen to be in Tokyo on May 11th, remember to stop by at 2 p.m. to watch our live conversation at Tokyo Comedy Bar with other great guests. Be sure to follow me on LinkedIn so that you can stay up to date with additional details. If you enjoyed today's episode, go ahead and share it with a friend, colleague, or connection on LinkedIn to help spread the perspectives and information shared in the podcast. And please remember to go ahead and subscribe or follow on whatever platform you use, and also leave a rating and review if you enjoy the podcast. If you would like to support the podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can support the podcast using the listener support button on Spotify for Podcasters, or contribute to my Ko-fi page to help me stay well-caffeinated and making content. You can find the link to do so in the description of this episode. As always, feel free to email me at businesssuccessjapan@gmail.com if you have any other questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes or interview topics. I'd love to hear from you directly, so if you'd like to leave a voice message, you can find a link to do that in the description as well. But for now, remember that the more you learn, the more confident you will become as you explore all of the opportunities Japan has to offer you. Until next time, mata kondo.